Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In the second half hour, we'll be hearing about how the DEA is proposing to reclassify marijuana as a less dangerous drug and what that could mean. But first, longtime South Texas Congressman Henry Cuellar was indicted on Friday. The Laredo Democrat and his wife, Imelda, are charged with bribery and money laundering related to their ties with a bank in Mexico and to an oil and gas company controlled by the Azerbaijani government. According to the indictment from 2014 to 2021, the Cuellars allegedly accepted roughly $600,000 in bribes in exchange for the congressman using his office to perform official acts for the benefit of the Azerbaijani government and the Mexican bank. Cuellar released a statement proclaiming his innocence and that he will continue to seek re-election to the 28th Congressional District, which stretches from Laredo to downtown San Antonio. To help us break down what this could mean for South Texas politics, we're joined by John Taylor, UTSA political science professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and Geography. And John Taylor, Professor Taylor, welcome back to The Source.
Thank you, David.
So many people might think you get indicted, you're running for re-election, and you don't got much chance of getting elected. But what does that look like really in South Texas?
The way it looks like elsewhere, which is apparently you can get indicted and run for re-election and possibly win. We've seen that with other people. We've got Bob Menendez in New Jersey, who's still demanding, you know, he's still going to run. You've got a certain Republican presidential presumptive nominee who's running, who's been indicted several places across the U.S. It's almost as though being indicted, running for office, doesn't have quite the same resonance it did, say, 10 or 20 years ago.
There have been some people who have questioned the timing of this indictment, seeing how this has been a long-running investigation into Henry Cuellar. We saw the raid on his home and office a couple of years ago before that re-election attempt, and then they told us, Cuellar and his attorney said he was not the target. Well, apparently he was the target of that investigation. But now we have a timing again, right as we're in an election season. Is there anything that should be read into when this DEA, when this indictment came out?
Honestly, I don't think so. I mean, it's a reminder that the federal government, that the DOJ, when it does its criminal investigations, you know, any sort of lack of news about it doesn't mean it's not socially happening. It's a case of we can't presume a case is ever dropped. By the way, I would also remind certain other politicians in this state who are facing potential for federal investigations and indictments that these criminal investigations take a long period of time. So the timing is the timing. I mean, just based on the way the feds operate. But that said, you know, if people think that somehow this is going to be swift justice, it's not. Look at what's happening in other bribery and other criminal trials for politicians right now.
Right, and some people are reading into this that there's the FBI or the Justice Department is signaling that there are Congress people who are being investigated for their January 6th activities.
Exactly.
And that they may be still could get a October surprise indictment.
In fact, I would agree with that. If you're a member of Congress and you are facing the possibility of something that happened because of January 6th, I would not rest easy at this point because the DOJ is still the DOJ and it will still bring down investigation, an indictment. It doesn't matter if it's a week before the election or right now.
Now, you mentioned Donald Trump. That adds a complication to this. And first of all, it makes it difficult for Republicans to say, criticize Cuellar, the Democrat, saying that he should resign or this is a disgrace. You can't have a candidate running for re-election when they're indicted, when they have Trump on trial right now, and he's been indicted multiple times for his alleged crimes. But Donald Trump has put himself into this conversation. He went out and he released a statement yesterday claiming that Biden was behind the indictment of Cuellar because Cuellar was tough on the border. What do you make of that?
With all due respect to the former president, I think that's a rather ludicrous statement to make, because this is not about the border. This is about Azerbaijan and influence peddling, and about money laundering with a Mexican bank. Nothing to do with the border and border control.
Right, but of course Trump is trying to make hay on this to benefit.
Oh, yeah.
But it does have a backfiring effect if Donald Trump is praising Henry Cuellar for him being tough on the border. That's not exactly good for the two Republicans who are still running to challenge Cuellar in November.
We have no question.
So there's Jay Furman and Lázaro Garza Jr. But go ahead.
I say no question, because basically what Trump has done is essentially to make indictments a wash for both parties. I mean, are you going to accuse somebody they should resign, or they shouldn't run for re-election because they've been indicted? Well, if that's the case, both parties are guilty of it. You basically have neutralized this issue.
So we've had this runoff, it's the May 28th runoff race for the GOP nomination, right, to challenge Henry Cuellar, and the race hasn't gotten a lot of attention between Jay Furman and Lázaro Garza Jr., but that's probably going to change now, I would think.
Yeah, it would probably change. In fact, what will likely happen is, and by the way, not to predict, but Furman was well out in front of Garza in this race, so you're going to assume that Furman would win the Republican nomination in the runoff. Just reading over Furman's stuff, he is a classic, you know, Trump-like Republican, everything from building the wall to sending migrants back across the border to, you know, defunding Ukraine to defunding green agenda and all that. And so what's going to be interesting is CD28 ready to vote for or potentially elect a guy who is far to the right of Henry Cuellar, who has made it a point to maintain himself as a moderate Democrat, as kind of that middle blue dog role within the party in the House. Again, Republicans may very well decide, like they did for CD15, that they may dump a lot of money into this race, viewing Cuellar as particularly vulnerable, and therefore maybe pick off the seat.
Well, there have been many of these progressives who have been critical of Nancy Pelosi of supporting Cuellar.
Right.
And they're saying that she should have backed his challenger, you know, a couple of primaries ago, Jessica
right.
Cisneros, who nearly knocked him off, and she would have been part of the squad, progressive squad. But do you think that, you know, that Nancy Pelosi was just trying to hang on to the seats and so that she could keep the majority?
That's exactly what she was doing. Nancy Pelosi and Jim Clyburn, that's exactly what they were trying to do, is to maintain that Democratic majority. They obviously lost it, but they didn't lose it by much. And I think you're going to – and it's kind of interesting, because this time Hakeem Jeffries has said, well, we're going to let it play out legally. You know, everybody has a right to a fair trial and the right to their day in court. And so, you know, he basically removed Cuellar from the House Appropriations Committee and the subcommittee ranking membership regarding Homeland Security. But yeah, it's one of these things where Democrats, be careful what you were trying to do in 22 to try to maintain your majority, which you lost. And in turn, you ended up, you know, potentially financing somebody who ends up maybe backbiting you basically in 2024.
All right, we got to wrap it up here, but I want to thank you, John
right.
Taylor, a political science professor, UTSA. Thank you so much for breaking down what's going on with Henry Cuellar. Henry Cuellar does say that he is innocent and that he will be have his day and that he will win re-election to the 28th Congressional District. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about rapid sea level rise in the Gulf of Mexico. What does that mean? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
Support for TPR comes from La Fonda on Main, honoring the authentic cuisine of interior Mexico since 1932. Open for lunch, brunch, and dinner. More information at lafondaonmain.com.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. A rapid burst of sea level rise has struck a region spanning from Brownsville to North Carolina. This is an area that's home to 28 million people. But it's also a place that has outdated flood control drainage infrastructure, and it just cannot keep up with all the water. As a result, when it rains, it floods, and the flood water has no place to go. The seas are swallowing coastal land, damaging property, submerging septic tanks, and making key roads increasingly impassable. This is the finding of a special report in the Washington Post. Brady Dennis is a Washington Post climate reporter and is part of the team that reported on the drowning South. And Brady Dennis, welcome to The Source.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So explain how sea level rise doesn't necessarily happen all over the world simultaneously, that there are different parts that will see a rapid rise more dramatic than other parts of the world.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, sea levels are rising throughout, great swaths of the world. And on average, the seas around the world are rising. But exactly like you said, there are places on the planet where seas have been rising faster for a variety of reasons. And that can have to do with geography, basically. I mean, ocean currents move, warmer water into places like the Gulf of Mexico, and warm water expands, and that is, exacerbating sea level rise that's already happening. There is other factors like sinking land that also exacerbates these trends. So, in a lot of places in the world, the sea is rising, but in places such as the U.S. South, it has been rising faster in the last 10 or 15 years.
Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you got a question or a comment about sea level rise, have you noticed something on the Texas coast? Have you seen these tides come in, king tides, that are making it difficult to get around? We're seeing flooding situations in Texas right now. The flood water just has no place to go. And so it backs up, especially during the tides. So what do you make of that? And how should we consider this? 833-877-8255. So Brady Dennis, you report that the scientists that you talk to are saying that what we are seeing is irreversible. What does that mean?
I think that it means, what they mean by that is that, the amount that seas have risen over the past, let's call it since 2010, which is the time period we focus on, the rate of sea level rise in those years has accelerated. Scientists don't know whether that is going to continue. They think that it's certainly possible that the rate of sea level rise sort of falls back down to a slower rate in coming years for various reasons. But the amount that's already happened, the amount of the amount that of higher water levels that already exist are there now and are not going to reverse themselves anytime soon. Partly that's because of melting at the poles, that puts more water into the oceans, and so some level of that is sort of baked in going forward. And I think most scientists would say that there's every expectation that sea levels continue to rise. I think the question is at what rate and at what speed that happens in any given place.
And y'all describe in your reporting in the Washington Post, the Drowning South, it's a very interactive presentation. It really just pops off the screen with all the information that you have. But you describe it as two different types of catastrophes that we're dealing with. One of them is the man-made environment. Another one is the natural environment. Let's talk about that really quick, about how we're seeing shallow coastal lands, different natural areas, swamp areas that are necessary, that they're being drowned as well. Explain that.
Yeah, my colleague Chris and I have written about this separately, as well as certainly mentioning it in these more recent stories. And just to take a place like Louisiana, for example, Louisiana has been losing land for many years. And in part, that is because wetlands, which naturally can move and can migrate over time, have not been able to do that in a lot of places quickly enough. The water is rising faster than these landscapes can adapt to it. And essentially what happens is they get drowned out, and what was once wetland or marsh becomes over time just more water, just open water. And so that is really contributing to the land loss, and it also sort of destroys a lot of the protections that a lot of these places have from, coastal storm surges. And, it was its own natural barrier.
And an important habitat.
Yeah. And it's certainly an important habitat and also, you know, a real economic boost to a lot of places. These are where the fisheries are and all sorts of things. So it has all these various impacts, both for the people who live nearby and for the wildlife that depends on these places.
Now, to the man-made environment, we do have drainage infrastructure. We have flood control. But in many of these places along the high populated coastal areas, it's just outdated, over a century old, you report, and just can't keep up with all this additional water. Is this something that needs to be invested in? It can be repaired. We can, you know, manage this.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it was one of the main things that I think drew us to look at these stories closely and to sort of go down this road, which is, you know, in so many places along the coastlines of America, like, as you mentioned, this infrastructure is often a century old, sometimes much older than that in certain cases. And it was built not just for another generation, it was built for another climate. And it was, so many of these systems rely on gravity to get water out to drain. And as the seas rise nearby, as you mentioned earlier, there's just no place for the water to go. And it's just it's literally a phrase that we heard over and over, both from scientists who study these places and from people who live there and from public officials who are trying to figure out what to do about it, is what do you do with water that has no place to go? And so, I mean, to your question, yes, there's a lot that can be done and a lot of updates and improving of infrastructure will certainly help the problem, but it's not an easy fix, and it's definitely, as we've learned, not an inexpensive one.
So are we living through a slow-moving disaster? Because the people who live in the coastal areas, are they, you know, putting up the red flag and saying, we got a problem here, or do they think this is just the way it is? You live on the coast, expect some flooding, what's it look like?
Yeah, I think you can encounter all those sentiments depending on, you know, where you are and who you talk to. Certainly some people think this is just part of life by the water, that sometimes you have these floods, and that there is certainly an element of truth to that. I think the people who study these things and a lot of the public officials whose job it is to deal with the damage and with the infrastructure that's failing would tell you that things are changing a lot faster than they were in the past, and that these problems are becoming more acute. I don't want to overstate things and say that, you know, our coastlines are going to be unlivable or anything like that, but certainly these changes are happening relative to history. They're happening very quickly, and it is having a growing set of impacts in a bigger number of places, and there's just every indication that's going to continue. So I just think that was one reason we focused on this particular subject, is that we all sort of intuitively know that hurricanes and big storms can cause huge damage and catastrophic damage. But just over and over again, we heard from scientists who study this that it's really the less catastrophic but more frequent flooding that is really the more kind of insidious and tough to deal with problem, and it will be going forward.
But the insurance companies, they've noticed what's really going on, and how are they reacting?
Well, as you say, they're very aware of this. And in many places, as I'm sure some of your listeners can attest, insurance rates have gone up very sharply. And so that's costing people money. And in some places, insurance companies have pulled out altogether in some of the riskiest places. They don't want to insure homes in some of the most flood-prone communities. So I think that's very much an open question what that means in some of these places. If you can't get insurance for your house any longer at some point, or if you can't get a mortgage to begin with, I do think there will be a real financial economic aspect to this that we're going to have to deal with in a lot of places.
And so you quote a scientist in your reporting that says, we're preparing for the wrong disaster. We've been putting a lot of money and interest in trying to deal with hurricanes and these, you know, rapid, very dramatic cinematic disasters, and not for this slow-moving disaster that's happening right in front of us. So what's it going to take? I mean, when does it reach the tipping point where it's like, okay, yeah, sea level rise is here. It's not 50 years from now. We're dealing with it right now, and we've got to address that.
Yeah. I mean, I do want to say that in the course of reporting these stories, it's very clear that a lot of people are fully aware of what's happening and really trying to plan and really trying to prepare and adapt to the changes. The difficulty compared to, say, like a hurricane, where you could, there's a proposed huge project, outside of Houston that would create, the Ike Dike that would try to guard that city and the regions around there from a huge catastrophic storm surge. It's a lot harder over this huge region to guard against every small flood. And certainly things like we're seeing more and more often, heavy rainstorms that combine with a high tide and cause flooding, whereas neither the rainstorm might not have been, biblical and the tide was not the highest ever, but when you combine them, it creates a big flood event. So I think that's the challenge, is that, it's so many places that are being affected by this. There's no one answer. It's different in every place. And so I think that's part of the challenge. And the other one is certainly just resources. These are expensive adaptations in any place, and every community sort of has a different resources, and some far fewer than others.
Yeah, so I was thinking, you're reporting from Brownsville to North Carolina, and I'm thinking about, wait, there's people who live south of Brownsville, Matamoros, all the way across the Mexican coastline on the, on the Gulf side. I mean, what's it look like down there? It's got to be the same, but, more exposed, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, I won't talk about below the border. I haven't, done enough research to really be informed on that. But, in a lot of places on the U.S. coastline, it's either very rural, and there's not a high density of people or local governments, or there is a lot of low-income minority communities that just don't have the resources of a large city to sort of fight some of these problems. So in all those places, whether it's a rural or low-income, I think there's a real question of how you deal with increased flooding and all that comes with that, because one reality is that there probably is more money available right now through things like the federal infrastructure bill, to get money towards some of these projects. But in a lot of places, there's no local people or fewer local people to apply for these grants and to pursue that money. And so it's not exactly a level playing field in all communities. And I think that's going to become only more clear over time.
Is there a particular community in on the coast, like in Texas, maybe perhaps, or not, depending on, do you recall, that you were particularly concerned about?
Well, I'd hesitate to say that there's one, because I am not an expert in Texas, but there's, certainly a lot of places where we saw the rate of sea level rise be exceptionally fast in this period that we looked at. I mean, one that's jumping into my mind right now is in the Galveston area, and certainly part of that is land sinking, is subsidence that area is dealing with, but certainly the seas have been rising as well. And I spent time talking with the local government officials there who are trying to put in a series of pumps that, are going to cost $50 to $60 million each. And a city like Galveston does not necessarily have that budget. So they are aggressively pursuing federal money and hoping to keep the water off of their streets and out of homes in that community in the years to come.
All right. Well, I want to thank you, Brady Dennis, for coming on board, talking to us about this. The Washington Post climate reporter. The name of the article is The Drowning South. Compelling read, great graphics. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back from the break, we're going to be talking about reclassifying marijuana as a less dangerous drug. Stay with us.
The EarthX 2024 Environmental and Sustainability Congress of Conferences is happening in Dallas, April 22nd through the 26th, bringing together all sides with one important mission: protect our planet. For info, earthx.org.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Marijuana could become a less illegal drug in the eyes of the federal government. The DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, is moving towards reclassifying marijuana as a less dangerous drug. The proposal would move marijuana from the Schedule 1 group to the less tightly regulated Schedule 3. And so this would be something that could make marijuana more accessible. The Justice Department proposal would recognize the medical uses of cannabis, but it wouldn't legalize it for recreational use. So what are the implications of reclassifying marijuana? We're joined by David Culliver. He is with the U.S. Cannabis Council. And David Culliver, welcome to The Source.
Thanks, David, for having me. Great to be with you.
So what does it mean to move marijuana from Schedule 1? Schedule 1 contains things like heroin, really scary drugs, and then putting it into Schedule 3.
Yeah, well, there are, I think it's important to understand the history of kind of how we got here, but I'll shelve that for a minute and answer your question directly. There are really three major impacts that we're going to see as a result of cannabis this move from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3, assuming that's where the process ends up. And we should probably talk a bit about the process, too, because it's interesting and not quite done yet. But the recommendation thus far is indeed to move it from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3. And the first thing that this is going to do is it's going to help ease the research restrictions that cannabis has felt for decades. We've had a really tough time researching the plant since it was placed on Schedule 1 in the Nixon administration, and this is going to ease it considerably, primarily because, as you said at the outset, the Department of Health and Human Services, and now the Drug Enforcement Administration, and specifically the Department of Justice, have recognized the medical benefits of cannabis. So that's number one. Number two is that for those that are operating in a state legal business, they are paying a tax, which is referred to as 280E. And that tax is very punitive and really, for most of these companies, puts their effective tax rate at about 80%, somewhere between 75 and 80%. So the move from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3 will remove that tax burden, will allow these businesses to take business deductibility, and will drop that effective tax rate considerably. So this is going to be commercially a really significant turning point for the entire industry. It's going to free up a lot of the cash that the industry's had a great deal of trouble accessing previously. And of course, it's very, very hard for any size business, large, medium, or small, to be effective and successful if you're paying that high of an effective tax rate. And then the final thing I'll mention is just the normalization of cannabis. You know, you mentioned heroin at the outset. Heroin is scary, and a lot of the other drugs on Schedule 1 are scary as well. Cannabis never should have been placed on there. It was placed contrary to science during the Nixon administration and was placed on Schedule 1 for political reasons. But the science, after a year and a half of review, has shown that it very clearly belongs on Schedule 3. So I think that a lot of elected officials that I interact with on a regular basis are going to be a lot more comfortable talking about opening up new cannabis programs in their state and, you know, potentially supporting cannabis reform measures that we've got here in Washington and in state capitals.
Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you had a question or a comment about the rescheduling of marijuana, give us a call. I got a question, let us hear from you. You can also send us an email to thesource@tpr.org. So, David Culliver, let's go back to the history of how marijuana became this demon drug. You say it was put on that Schedule 1. The Nixon administration, there is documentation showing that not only was this a political move, but it was a racist move?
Yeah, that's right. So this was decades ago, more than 50 years ago, and cannabis has been used, unfortunately, to put people of color in prison. And the statistics that are out there are staggering. People of color are four times more likely to be arrested for a cannabis conviction than those that are not. And again, this plant was, you know, used primarily to target Black and Hispanic men. And very successfully, I might add, our government did so for 50 plus years. But fast forward to 2020, and President Biden, now President Biden, candidate Biden then, he made a pretty bold policy position for him, given the positions that he's taken on cannabis reform and the war on drugs. And he decided that he was going to champion, in a modest way, cannabis reform issues during the campaign. And he basically said that no one should be in jail for using or possessing cannabis. And this was a big breakthrough for him personally and for the campaign. And obviously the whole industry saw his victory, along with a Democratic sweep of the House and the Senate, as a really incredible opportunity to advance cannabis reform in Washington. Unfortunately, we did not see any action out of the administration until October 6th of 2022. But the president's actions on that day were significant, and he announced three things. One was that he was going to pardon those with federal cannabis offenses, so the thousands of people that exist that have those. He also encouraged state governors to expunge the records of those with state-level nonviolent cannabis-related offenses, and this was important because the bulk of cannabis arrests actually occur in the states. And then the third thing that he did, which is what we're talking about here today, is he initiated, which is within his power, the review of where cannabis should be on schedule. And during that presentation, he tasked the Secretary of the Health and Human Services Department and also the Secretary of the Department of Justice to begin the process. And specifically within each agency, HHS was to start. And within that agency, it was the Food and Drug Administration that would lead. That process took until the very end of August 2023. And HHS announced that after their full scientific review, they were recommending that cannabis move from Schedule 1 down to Schedule 3. And ultimately, their findings, they were 252 pages long. Those were released to the American public shortly thereafter. And then on Tuesday of last week, the media reported that the Department of Justice had confirmed that they were also going to follow the recommendation of HHS and recommend that cannabis is moved from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3. So they took a little over 8 months to do their part of the work, but again, went through a very thorough review, just as HHS did. So that's where we stand in the process. And this news is a week old. And I think it goes without saying that, you know, the reclassification of cannabis to Schedule 3, if that's where we end up, will mark the most significant federal cannabis reform in modern history and place the U.S. on a clear path towards the ultimate goal of federal legalization, which is what our goal is at the U.S. Cannabis Council.
So what needs to happen now to actually make it a Schedule 1 drug?
Yeah, Schedule 3?
Schedule 3, yes, I'm sorry. It's hard to keep track.
Yeah,
you said, so worry. Schedule 1 is the worst stuff. And Schedule
1 is the worst stuff,
yep. Okay.
And as you move down schedule, then you start to see medical value of these products.
Because ketamine is also a Schedule 3.
That's right. Same as Tylenol with codeine, just to give some parallels there. But, you know, nothing as dangerous as heroin. So in any case, what is going to happen now is the Department of Justice will send their document to the White House Office of Management and Budget, where they have an agency within OMB that will review the document itself. And then it will actually go back to the Department of Justice, where they will have a 60-day public comment period. And anybody can comment on this, on the work that they've done, on their suggestion to move it from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3. And if folks do have an opinion, I do strongly encourage them to do so. We will be registering our comment through U.S. Cannabis Council in a very positive way, as will our member companies. But that public comment will occur over a 60-day period. There's also the possibility that there could be an administrative law judge review and or hearing within that period of time. And there's a lot of speculation about how long that would take. Some folks feel that piece of it could drag out significantly. But I think it actually would be fairly quick, so within 30 to 60 days. So I think that if they move things along in a timely manner, there's a real possibility that we could see the Department of Justice and specifically the DEA issue their final rule before the election.
It's as interesting as you talked about the long trail to get where we are right now. There has been this impression by some saying that the Biden administration is doing this now because of the election, but actually this has been a long time coming, right?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, look, this is absolutely it's a presidential election year. Politics are at the forefront of everything that's going on right now. So that needs to be acknowledged. But to say that the process has actually been scarred as a result of the politics, or has been hurried along or moved in a direction that it shouldn't go, I think is false. The work that we saw, and again, I'll go back and reference the 252-page document that the Health and Human Services Department did, that document is very thorough and makes a very compelling scientific case for cannabis to be moved from Schedule 1 down to Schedule 3. And DEA has done also a very thorough and diligent job. So the announcement and the decisions that they've made are based on the merits of the process, not the politics.
All right, we're going to take this one-minute break, but when we come back, I'll ask you about Texas, and the answer is, I'm sure, it's complicated. But let's do that. And our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The source continues right after this. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about if marijuana gets reclassified, would it legalize recreational cannabis nationwide? What would it mean for Texas? If you've got a question, a comment about the reclassification of marijuana, making it less illegal in the federal eyes, the number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can send us an email to the source at tpr.org. You can text us at that call-in number, 833-877-8255. And so David Culver is with the U.S. Cannabis Council. And, you know, we have a patchwork across the United States of what marijuana is, you know, depending on what state you're in at any given time. We have marijuana programs, medical marijuana programs licensed in 38 states. It's a legal recreational cannabis market in 23 states. It just seems odd that something like this varies on what state you're in. So what do you think this would do for creating a national you know, way of dealing with marijuana? And what would happen in Texas?
Yeah, good question. David, it is odd that we have this state patchwork. And it is something that I advocate here in Washington on a regular basis for Congress to go ahead and act legislatively to remove cannabis from schedule altogether, which would allow them the ability to regulate these products just as they do beverage alcohol. And the regulatory scheme that I've been talking about for many, many years is different from alcohol, but yet it would provide that federal oversight that I think we desperately need. But we are in the situation, just as you rightly pointed out, where we do have the bulk of the country with some form of medical program and or adult use program in the cannabis space. And some of these programs are very limited. Others are more expansive. And some states have actually tried to open the market up in the adult use space as much as they possibly can. They are operating right now for a number of reasons, one being an appropriations rider that continues to ride on these appropriations packages here in Washington that would not allow programs in the state to have to worry about any sort of federal interference. But the move from Schedule 1 down to Schedule 3 is actually not going to have any impact, direct impact or legal impact on any of the adult use or medical use markets across the United States. So there's been a lot of folks that have called wondering whether or not this would actually create a medical market in their state. Because it is the Food and Drug Administration is recognizing the medical use of cannabis, and would this create a medical market? The answer is no. But what I do think it's going to do is, back to a point I made earlier about elected officials and their comfort level with cannabis, I do think that because the federal government has made a very compelling case around the medical uses of cannabis, that I do think elected officials are going to start to think about creating medical or adult use markets in their own state and have a lot more comfort doing so. So I'm hopeful that medical programs like in Texas, you have the Texas Compassionate Use Program. I think that this is going to be, if we do end up at Schedule 3, a real opportunity to talk with leaders in the state about expanding it.
Right, because it's very narrow right now. It's very limited.
It is very narrow, and it's very limited. And, you know, again, the FDA's review found that there's credible scientific evidence for certain conditions like chronic pain and nausea and vomiting as a result of cancer treatments. So I really do feel like that HHS document that was submitted last year to the DEA is something that, you know, we're going to be using across the country to try to expand these limited programs. And Texas is a really good example of a program that is limited. The other thing that is complicated, David, but is certainly worth mentioning, is that as a result of hemp legalization, which this goes back to the federal farm bill in 2018, many individuals without access to robust medical programs are turning to this really large and very accessible hemp marketplace, both illicit and legal, because there is a wide variety of unregulated and intoxicating hemp products that really can have the same impact as products that you're buying in medical and adult use spaces, with the exception of the fact that, again, they're unregulated, they're often untested, and there's really, it's difficult to make sure that they're not adulterated. So we're in the midst of this conversation across the country, and it's something that I think many in state capitals are starting to tackle.
Let's go to a caller. We have Sandra, and our number is 833-877-8255. Sandra, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. My comment is, I taught public high school for 10 years, and every child that was lost to dropout, jail time, or death when they got to cocaine and heroin started out on marijuana. And I know, because I would bust them when they were high. So this is an absolute horrible idea, and will further destroy our nation and our young people, because once they start, you know, into adulthood, when we may say it's legal, it's too late.
Senator, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate your feedback on that. So, David Culliver, can you address Sandra's concerns?
Yeah, I can. Of course, I appreciate the caller's work primarily as a teacher. I come from a family of them, so thank you for your work there. There is a very, very long list of studies that have been done related to cannabis as a gateway drug, and there's absolutely no truth that cannabis is a gateway drug. And if the caller is interested, she can certainly reach out directly to U.S. Cannabis Council, and I'd be happy to provide this. The other thing that we have seen recently is that there was a study that the federal government put out related to states that had legalized and the impact that legalization had had on youth, and specifically youth access, which with any sort of intoxicant, you want to make sure that you do not have, the youth are not able to get their hands on it and that it's properly age gated. And so the study did show that there was not any increase whatsoever in youth access when there was a legal program. And this really just emphasizes the point that I made earlier about a federal regulatory system or a really strong state regulatory system. The best way to protect the roadways and to protect the kids and to make sure that, well, to make sure the kids don't get their hands on it and to make sure that the products are not adulterated is to regulate, tax, and test. And that's what we advocate for in state capitals. And of course, I continue to push for here in Washington.
So you mentioned earlier about people who were imprisoned on federal marijuana trafficking charges. So what would they be released, or they're already released? I really didn't follow that. Explain that again.
Yeah. So just to be clear, it's these would be nonviolent possession or use charges these individuals had been charged with, and nothing to do with distribution. So I want to make sure I'm clear there. But what the president called for in 2022 was a pardon of those individuals, and he asked his Department of Justice to set up a system for these pardons, which they have done, and they are issuing them. They've issued quite a few this year, actually, over 1,000, and I think we'll see a bunch more. But just as a reminder to you and to the audience, the bulk of the cannabis arrests over the last 5 decades have occurred in the states. And so it's really important. The president called on governors across the country to expunge the records of those with nonviolent cannabis-related offenses, and many governors have done so. And I think we'll see more to come in the future. There is a cost associated with it. There is a bill here in Washington that we're working on called the HOPE Act that would provide funding for said expungement work in the states. But this would be, I think, as significant a thing as any state could do in terms of changing individuals' lives, because living with these, even these nonviolent criminal offenses that many folks have, just makes their lives very, very difficult.
And with this rescheduling of marijuana, I've heard all these horror stories about these legal pot dispensaries in other states, but they can't bank. Would that change that?
No, it would not change the banking at all, which is, and I'm glad you asked that, because we are working very, very hard this year again on a piece of legislation called the Safe Banking Act, which it's basically a public safety bill, and this would take the cash out of the cannabis business the system altogether. So right now these cannabis businesses are operating in an all-cash way, and that's obviously dangerous. It leaves them open as targets for crime, and there's even been a number of deaths across the country as a result of said robberies. So the Safe Banking Act is a piece of legislation that would provide safe harbor for banks to service state legal businesses. We feel like we're getting pretty close here in Washington. There's been some discussion about it being attached to the piece of legislation that's on the Senate floor right now, the Federal Aviation Administration Reauthorization Act. But I think more likely we will see that piece of legislation either move on its own later this summer or during the lame duck period, which is that period of time after the election where they're typically able to shelve the politics for a couple months and get a bunch of stuff done. But we still need the Safe Banking Act. This move to Schedule 3 does not solve that in any way.
Right, and we're out of time, but I want to bottom line this and correct me if this is right or wrong. It doesn't really impact, rescheduling doesn't really impact what's happening in Texas. It absolutely doesn't impact what's happening in Texas, but it could provide some slack or some lubricant, so maybe down the line our lawmakers would find their way to relax the state marijuana laws, either recreationally or medically. Is that right?
That's right, David, and we do hope that this helps to normalize it for the good folks in Texas, and that your medical program in the state is able to expand as a result of this.
David Culver is with the U.S. Cannabis Council. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, David.
And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.